Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation.
And a good evening to you. You are listening to KZSC Santa Cruz at UCSC. Dr. Dawn Motyka is back for her monthly visit. Hi, good evening, Dawn.
Well, thank you very much for having me back, John. It's always very exciting to come and talk with you, and I have some lovely and interesting science stories, some of personal anecdotes, some emails, and of course, we'll be taking your calls after 7:30. So I want to talk about your genes, and of course, genes influence everything, but a couple of years ago, I was doing my 23andMe, and they had a little question, do you want to take a quiz, you know, to help us with our research? And so this research that I'm about to read you came directly out of that quiz, which I think might be as much as 5 years ago. And for the quiz itself, how it worked is they would show you just the picture of someone's eyes. So you know the old-fashioned blackouts when they used to hide someone's identity by putting a black bar across their eyes. So it was often done in on newspapers and magazines, you know, if someone done something naughty and you didn't want to identify them. Well, what they did was if you took those eyes back and just showed the eyes without the face. So it would be just a rectangle around the eyes. And then they asked you, what's the emotion? And they gave you four choices, and you had to pick which emotion you felt corresponded to those eyes. And, of course, there's subtle muscles around the eye, and there's a little bit of eyebrow that you can see. So I took the test, and I actually got a really good score. And being a good little doctor monkey who always wants to get an A in everything, it gave me a nice little dopamine surge. But this research then looked at genetics, and they looked at sex, and this is what I'm about to read. It was published in Molecular Psychiatry. And what it did was use this reading the eyes test that was developed at Cambridge like 20 years ago to test a quality called cognitive empathy. And people can rapidly interpret the emotion that someone's feeling just by looking at their eyes, but some people are better at it than others. Now, it turns out that of the 90,000 people across the world who participated in this study, there were some who were really, really good at it. And the performance in this test correlated to a specific gene. That gene's called the leucine-rich neuronal 1. Don't expect these genes' names to be very illuminating. But anyway, LRRN1 is very active in a part of the brain called the striatum. And this has been shown with brain scanning, like functional MRI, to correlate with cognitive empathy, with the act of putting yourself in someone else's shoes, so to speak. And so genetic variants in this DNA that were picked up by 23andMe turned out to be correlated with having a larger volume of this striatum, which also correlates. And interestingly enough, people with autism who are notoriously bad at reading emotional signals have very, very small striatal structures. So we may have found a locus in the brain that's critical for our ability to mirror other people, to put ourselves in someone else's shoes. And I can think of a certain president whose name starts with T who could use some augmentation in his striatum, in my opinion. Maybe a few other neurological structures
Can you add more or take some away? Is it one of those kind of things?
It is beyond our technology at this time. However, it might be possible to actually code for this. If we go back to CRISPR, remember that gene editing thing that I've talked about before on the program?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you could take copies of this gene, and you could add extra copies of the LRRN one gene, and you could literally edit that into someone's chromosome 3, and they would produce more of this protein. And the question is, well, would that have some other adverse effect, or would it simply improve the person's empathy ability? And that would have to be tested by perforce in humans, so you'd want to be very careful about it. But I think that's where we're headed. Is
sounds sort of Frankenstein-y.
Well, Frankenstein could have done a much better job if he'd had better sourcing on his parts, right?
Right.
If you remember the book, the problem is that he couldn't find a healthy brain. He could only find a damaged brain. And of course, If he had a brand new, spanking, shiny, new, healthy brain, and he had healthy organs, he might have been able to put together the Superman that he was striving for in that fictional story. And I do think we're headed for a new species, if you want. Homer Crisporus, perhaps,
yes.
We will call it. But we've gotten to the point where we are almost on the brink of being able to evolve ourselves along lines that we, and now it's subject of serious debate in science. Do we want to evolve ourselves? Are we sure we know enough to do it right? And are there things about these quote-unquote bad genes, like cystic fibrosis, that actually might provide some kind of benefit, just in the way that when you monocrop a potato, you get a potato famine? Could we accidentally breed some survival traits out of the human race if we went whole hog on fixing the genome at our current state-of-the-art knowledge? It's an interesting question.
Really? Really?
So our next story is about DNA, and this one I think a lot of people don't realize that the placenta is actually from the father's genetics. And when I'm a woman and I get pregnant, the placenta is not coming from my body. It's actually coming from the baby's body. And most of the DNA that's actively read to create that placenta is actually the father's DNA.
Wow.
So how cool is that?
You know, when those things come up, I always say, how do they know? I mean, how did they figure that one
out? Well,
you
get lots of placentas.
Yeah.
Every time you get a baby, you get a placenta. And you can run the genetics on that placenta. Now, we know it's going to be the baby's genetics, obviously, because the placenta comes from that single fertilized egg. But the baby has two sets of chromosomes, and the mother's chromosomes, are sort of, well, mom gets kind of an extra bunch of chromosomes to give the baby, because the baby ends up with her mitochondrial DNA. And so the egg has mitochondria in it, which are the energy cells, the energy factories of mm-hmm. the cell. And the egg is big, and it's full of mitochondria. And it's got a nucleus, and that's where mom's DNA is. But the mitochondrial DNA goes along for the ride during fertilization and development. So the baby's mitochondria all come from the mom. And the placenta pretty much is the dad's DNA. Mom's DNA is in there, but it's not being read. So there's a strong correlation between the presence of a particular gene. This gene codes for a protein called SFLT1. And this SFLT1 is made by the placenta, and we can pick it up in the mother's blood. And if the placenta overproduces this protein, then the mother sustains vascular damage, and she develops hypertension and can go on to get eclampsia, which is a very, very serious disease leading to seizures and sometimes even death of both the mother and the baby. But the first sign that you see is you see leakage of protein into the urine, and you see high blood pressure. And that's why women go in for those prenatal visits, and we measure the baby. Pretty much, we measure the baby. Once they're old enough, we listen to the heartbeat, and we check the blood pressure and the urine, and we look for protein and sugar. And if we find protein, well, we're worried about, then we call it preeclampsia. And if we find sugar, well, then we call that gestational diabetes. And those are the things. Those are the things we do prenatal care to catch, because they are so common and so damaging to the mother and the baby, and so treatable. So now that we know that this blood level of SVLT is there, we might start doing genetic testing and looking for the gene in the amniotic fluid. We might be able to just look at the protein, and this would be more practical, look at the protein in the mother's blood and say, okay, your levels are going up. You're at risk for preeclampsia. We're going to change your monitoring to twice a week, or we're going to give you a blood pressure cuff and have you check your own urine every day. So we might be able to change the way we do prenatal care, personalize it a little bit, and still do a good job of protecting the babies, possibly some cost effectiveness there. So that's interesting. And I particularly like the fact about the placenta, because we think that there may be a connection also with placental DNA and autism. Everyone is frantic to figure out why autism is going up. And one hypothesis is that it's epigenetic changes in the sperm. And if that's the case, that could fit, because the placenta, as I've said, is coming from the father. So that may be how that mechanism plays itself out.
All right, I got a good percentage of that today.
All right.
You are listening to KZSC's Talk About Show. Who you're listening to right now is Dr. Don Motyka.
Now, we talked about prostate cancer last month, and this one is particularly cool. This is from University of Texas at Austin, and it was published this week online in a journal, if you can call it a journal when it's online, Precision Oncology. They looked at basically proving what we in functional medicine have been saying for a very long time, which is that turmeric, apple skin, and red grapes, resveratrol in particular, and a compound called ursolic acid, which you also find in rosemary, these compounds actually starve cancer cells by preventing them from eating. Cancer cells require a couple of basic things. They require glucose, and one of the only amino acids that they can use for growth is the amino acid glutamine. And if you eat a combination of curcumin and resveratrol and ursolic acid, let's see, it's either ursolic acid with curcumin or with resveratrol, which is what comes from the red grapes, you block the uptake of glutamine. And so now we have an explanation for the mechanism of the association that we've been giving out for quite some time. I think it was 5 years ago that I attended a functional medicine annual conference where a number of cancer doctors who are alternative cancer doctors came and talked about their therapies. And one of the common threads that ran through was green tea, curcumin, resveratrol, and a list of fruits and vegetables as long as your arm. Each one of these has its own particular mechanism, but they're all actually changing the genetics, the epigenetics, I mean, of the cancer cell, turning that cancer cell, which, remember, is a normal human cell gone rogue, turning it back into a normal cell by going into the DNA and turning off the cancer genes that are turned on. And we have proof of that, and we have proof also of this mechanism for actually preventing the cancer cells from being able to eat.
What is curcumin?
Curcumin is the substance in turmeric. Turmeric is a yellow root similar to ginger that's used in Indian cooking. You'll find it in curry.
That's the one that's coming through on the internet now. There's one ad after another. There's a picture of it, and then another naturopath to put together with that.
Right. Well,
you get 10 of them a day ads for this, you know.
Well, I don't get many ads. I think I've got a really good ad blocker.
Yeah.
Anyway, yes, that's the stuff. And if you're going to use turmeric, if you're going to use the raw root, you can vastly improve the absorption by doing two things: combining your turmeric with some kind of fat and black pepper.
Black pepper.
So I usually advise a 10-to-1 ratio of black pepper. So if you're going to have, let's say, a tablespoon of turmeric, which would be about the dose you'd want to use daily for health, you'd use more if you had cancer. And you'd use about a tenth of a tablespoon of, which would be what, a third, it would be about a third of a teaspoon of the black pepper. And you could take that and blend it up and put it in food. You could stick it in capsules and then chase it with a little fish oil or a little coconut oil, and you have all those in your stomach at the same time, and that really improves the absorption. There are also excellent extracts that are made by commercial entities. And for my cancer patients, because I'm having them take, well, the equivalent of maybe a quarter cup, a third of a cup of turmeric a day in curcumin, you can't do that. That's not viable. So I have them use extracts because you needed 3,000 or 4,000 milligrams of the stuff to turn a cancer around.
Okay.
But you can at least move the cancers. I'm not saying you can cure cancer. I'm saying that you can sort of put it into a slow grow mode that your immune system can stay on top of.
Okay. And I know there's more details, and I'll get those from you after the show. We'd really like to know a little bit more about that.
Sure. It's an amazing amount of data that is coming in. As I read through these science articles as they come out, they're validating all of these things that, I'm very happy to see these things validated and put out in the general literature, because this information was there, but it was obscure, and it's buried in the nutrition literature that doctors don't read.
Yeah.
And, you know, now it's coming out on Science Daily, and there's a chance that people will actually see it. And there's so many thousands of people who can benefit from just shifting their diet and using some of these nutritionals, particularly people fighting cancer, who get lousy diet advice. Horrible nutrition advice from their doctors. Tell them, go ahead, eat whatever you can eat. Have ice cream. Drink milkshakes. That's the advice my father got with his prostate cancer. And basically, they were just feeding his cancer cells sugar, which is exactly what the cancer cells want. It was crazy.
Well, it's funny how you, when you look back at medical history, what was good for you at one point is bad for you, and what was bad for you now is good for you. Coffee and chocolate seem to go through that whole track time after time. Oh, it's good for you now. No, it's not so good for you.
Well, you know, we do know that's the next story, so thank you for the lead in. We do know that.
Great segue.
Indeed. What I expect no less from a professional
such as
yourself.
Harumph,
harumph. So, we do know that tea and coffee lead to changes that reduce cancer risk, and they modulate the disease risk by suppressing tumor progression. But tea is particularly beneficial, and in women now we've traced the epigenetic changes in genes that are known to interact with cancer. So this comes from work done at Uppsala University, where they looked at the genome of women who were tea drinkers, and they found important improvement in the epigenetics for the genes involved in cancer and estrogen metabolism. So women who, for example, who drank tea, particularly green tea, regularly, were able to get rid of estrogen more readily. So it didn't hang around in their bodies, and that reduces the amount of risk you have for breast cancer, because there is a link between high levels of estrogen and cancer. The argument is, what's the safe level? And we continue to have that argument. But the epigenetic changes were stronger in women. We didn't see any epigenetic changes in men in this particular aspect of physiology, but they did see epigenetic changes in other cancer-related genes. And so tea, green tea in particular, is really good for you. And the studies that have done epidemiological work suggest that the dose is about 5 cups a day. So a pot of green tea sipped on throughout the day, hot or cold, does the trick all by itself without having to buy expensive extracts. But again, if you're fighting cancer, I do put people on 1,000 milligrams of ECGC, which is one of the green tea extracts that is very good for your heart and very good as an anti-cancer drug. I thought a couple of months ago we talked about the microbiome, the gut bacteria, and emotion, and there was some links with depression. This paper that just came out shows that a particular bacteria called Lactobacillus rhamnosus, it's my favorite probiotic, Lactobacillus, because it treats asthma and eczema. And so I give it to all my children with asthma or eczema, any adult with allergies, I have them on it. I cured my own hay fever and allergies with this particular probiotic or with the mix that I'm taking. Spring used to be awful for me. I would sneeze, my eyes would water, I would wheeze a little bit if I ran and it was a lot of pollen. No longer. And it's just by changing the microbiome. However, this research is actually showing that this same bacteria shifts mood directly. And they're using laboratory animals, but I think it's probably going to prove to be true in humans as well. But with rats, you can chop up their brains and look at what's going on. They showed that the receptors for the calming hormone GABA that's released in your brain, it's a neurotransmitter and a hormone, that the receptors change in response to this bacterium. And if you give this bacteria to the rats, the calming, the ratio of receptors for GABA changes in the prefrontal cortex and in the limbic system, which is the seat of emotion. So they took rats and they gave that were prone to depression, and they gave them a GABAergic test, so to speak, and looked at what the receptors were in the brain, and then they gave them this bacteria, waited a while, and the receptors flipped. Another group of rats, they didn't cut their brains open, but did the same thing. They then tested their behavior, and they found that it provided protection against creating depression in these depression-prone rats. Furthermore, they found if they cut the nerve between the stomach and the brain, that's called the vagus nerve, the effect disappeared. So somehow the presence of this bacteria in the stomach is creating neurotransmitters, some kind of signal, and that signal is climbing up the vagus nerve to get to the brain of the rats. And how cool is that?
I'm always overwhelmed by what people in that profession do and how they figure out how we would do this. It's you know, to the layperson, it's just overwhelming.
It's thousands, tens of thousands of dedicated, smart people,
yeah.
Researchers, people with PhDs. Dedicated smart people is a nice way of putting it. And they've dedicated themselves to discovering things, and they're focused on things that can actually benefit humanity.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And my hat's off to them. We have a great number of them up here at UC, and this is a place that's making enormous contributions in the field of genetics and genomics. I don't know if you knew that.
I didn't, but did you work in that field at all?
No, I worked in neuroanatomy and neurophysiology and psychology as an undergraduate, and then went on and got my MD. But I'm fascinated really right now by this DNA work and the genomics and what we're learning and how the genes of the bacteria in our intestines are having an effect on us. It's a game changer in worldview. It's like suddenly the world is round instead of flat. It's at that level of a shift. Talk about epigenetics in the brain. This study looked at something that many people are probably aware of. It's called the ACE trial, and this was the Adverse Childhood Experiences trial. And what it showed, if you don't know this research, you should look it up. Just Google ACE trial. Because what it showed is if you have a bad childhood, if you lose a parent, if you're abused, if you have alcoholism in the home, your lifetime risk for cancer, your lifetime risk for suicide, well, maybe that one's not so surprising, but you name the disease, multiple sclerosis, heart disease, skin cancer, diabetes, your risk for these things is higher if you had adverse childhood experiences. Your risk for chronic pain, fibromyalgia, just everything you can think of is higher. This data came from Kaiser, so they knew this because they have these longitudinal patients that they can really data mine. The mechanism for this turns out to be a location in the brain, and we've actually gotten to the point where we can say it's this DNA, it's a promoter region in the brain. It's a piece of DNA that's a start signal, and when you push this and something jumps onto that, it's called a homeobox. And when something jumps onto that box, it starts DNA being replicated. It starts messenger RNA being made. And that messenger RNA goes to the cell, and the cell makes proteins out of it. And those proteins change the threshold for developing depression for the rest of your life. And what's even cooler about this is, you know, amblyopia, right? Kid has a lazy eye, and you got to patch it because you've only got about 5 years before the brain develops so that the eye will be okay and have 20/20 vision. If you miss that critical period, the brain never develops right. Well, that's what happens here. There's a critical period where if the child is abused, their brain changes. It learns to be depressed. And even though it reverts to normal and you can't tell later on, when the person as an adult gets something else bad that happens to them, they get into an abusive relationship, they lose their job, they have a bereavement, the DNA turns back on and they start making essentially the messenger RNA of depression, and they become depressed. And it's that predilection for depression, it's not genetic, it's epigenetic. It's created by a bad childhood. So maybe we can find a way to heal that. Or maybe it will prove to be a way of targeting better drugs for depression. But the fact that we now understand that adverse childhood experiences leave an imprint that's not psychological, it's actually genetic. Again, for me, that's a world goes from flat to round kind of shift.
How does it become genetic when you already, you know, you're born with the genes you get, right?
Well, here's what happens. Those genes are either turned on or they're turned off, okay? And when we are hurt or injured, there's some genes that get turned on. And the start signal gets altered. That's if it's in childhood. Now, once that start signal is offered, it is altered, it's primed to fire off more easily. So we haven't changed the genetic sequence, but what we've done is we've changed the way the promoter region is going to react. And so it's like the accelerator is, have you ever had a car where the accelerator was really sticky and it went from, it was like you were idling or you were doing 50 miles an hour and, you know, you really couldn't go slowly? Well, it's like that. Instead of being able to ramp up slowly, the minute something bad happens, that DNA for depression, that box gets stimulated, but it just takes off and starts making copy after copy. So it's on a hair trigger. And so that person has a lifetime vulnerability that is not genetic, but epigenetic. Do you see?
Uh-huh.
That's the mechanism. And 10 years ago, who knew? We didn't know epigenetics from anything. It's doctors. There's still plenty of doctors who don't even know what it is. But it is important.
As an MD, aren't you required to continue your continuing studies?
Oh, CME. Let me tell you the dirty, evil secret of medical CME. It costs money.
Yeah.
I spend probably between $7,000 and $10,000 a year on educational stuff. You know, between the travel and the hotel and going to these conferences, I spend a lot of money keeping my brain fed. Doctors can get all the CME they need by going to free educational classes that are offered, usually with a free dinner to boot, and they can go to grand rounds at their hospital. They can go online and get free educational courses that will, which are validated continuing medical education. Just about every single one of these, I mean every single one of them, is funded by the pharmaceutical industry.
Not interesting, but a surprise.
So it's good information, but let's just say it's got some spin.
Yeah.
It's got a little spin.
It seems to me I've just read someplace that there's some rules have changed that that the pharmaceutical companies cannot give as much many gifts or trips or those kind of things.
Yeah, they can't fly me to the Bahamas for the dinner.
Yeah.
And I don't think they've done anything about speakers' fees with this latest legislation. They can't give you fancy gifts, not that I ever got any fancy gifts because I'm just a primary care doctor, but, you know, the oncologists and people who are in a position to spend, rheumatologists, the people who are in position to spend some very big money on, you know, so, that belongs to other people,
right.
OPM. So those people get, we're sometimes getting some very, very nice presents and also just speaker's fees to go give a lecture. And yeah, $5,000 for an afternoon to give a lecture as a thought leader in your field. It's kind of flattering, kind of profitable.
Sounds good.
And you can make $50,000, $70,000 a year that way on the side without breaking a sweat. So, yeah, that's one way that, that's something that should be gone after. But they haven't touched the CME. They haven't touched these infomercials.
Well, you know, there's so much going on that you, in all fields, people taking advantage as often and as much as they can. I mean, that seems to be sort of in our DNA to, you know, if we can get 10 more dollars for something than somebody else, we don't care who suffers.
Well, speak for yourself. I think there's a lot of good people out there who wouldn't take the 10 bucks over someone else's suffering. And what we need to do is honor and highlight that behavior. We have a tendency currently in our culture to highlight the nasty bad behavior, and it makes you feel like you're missing out by not being dishonorable, that, you know, you're somehow losing out, you're being a patsy, you're being a chump, you're being stupid to be moral. We need to celebrate morality and generosity, and we should be advertising, look what this person did, look what this person did, ain't that great, rather than looking at these, you know, fake reality shows with, you know, scripted bad behavior and assuming that that's how everyone else is.
Let's hope not.
Well,
sure.
we've got a perception problem in terms of humanity, but I talk to a lot of people and most of them are pretty darn good. Looks like we've got a call.
And you are on the air with Don.
Hey there. Hi, John. Hi, Don.
Hi.
I'm surprised Don knows all about President Truman's brain. It's been a long time since he was president. But, but anyway, I'm happy to hear this being talked about on the air again. If you know, remember Ralph Rutherford on KAZU before it went away? On his show
KUSP,
called Mind,
maybe?
Body, and Medicine. And Adam Atman on KKUP talked about a lot of things like this all the time. So excellent to hear this being continued. I'm surprised a coworker of mine has a sister whose knee was giving out, and she got a stem cell injection and had to go to South Korea to get it. But he said she's going to run a marathon now instead of having a knee replacement, and he wasn't joking. So this is kind of surprising to me. It's a whole new ballgame if stem cells work out like that. Any comments?
Well, actually, I do have comments. I think stem cells are not ready for prime time yet. There's one case, and it's just one case. It's scary enough to give you pause. And this was a guy who was getting stem cells intrathecally, in other words, into the spinal column, to try to help a damaged brain because he had had a stroke. And what he ended up with was a really nasty tumor because some of these stem cells actually decided to stay where they were and grow. And it was basically impossible to treat. It was chemotherapy resistant. It wasn't a cancer. It didn't have any of the vulnerabilities of cancer cells. It was healthy embryologic tissue. And it would, you know, you give embryologic tissue a blood supply and it's going to grow. So I do worry about stem cells. And I think there are some studies being done with your own stem cells, you know, just taking them out of your bone marrow and re-injecting them, and maybe that's what she had done. And I'm not so worried about those, but I am worried about the embryological stem cells, and I don't think that should actually be allowed. It isn't allowed here. If it's allowed in South Korea, that's great. But she's basically volunteering to be a guinea pig. And what if one in 1,000 people get cancer from it? You know, how many, and we're not doing this systematically. We'd really have to have a whole lot of people get it before we would notice, because it's being done privately and it's not being watched or tracked. So it makes me very nervous, the embryologic stem cell injections, and it will continue to do so. However, I think, like I said, from your bone marrow, go for it. Go be a guinea pig, pave the trail, and there's certainly plenty of anecdotal evidence that's positive. And I know somebody's out there is doing a study somewhere, but not in this country.
Yeah, these were allegedly harvested from her abdominal fat.
Right.
My question is, say that the cells are there and it works, the body's really good at healing itself. Why doesn't the body mobilize the stem cell itself to the affected area and regenerate like a starfish? But maybe it's a matter of time if we find the right combination of stimulants.
Well, we do to a certain extent. If you're 3 years old and you chop off the tip of your index finger, if you keep it clean, it'll grow back. You'll grow back the bone. You'll even regenerate a joint if you're 3 years old. Now, by the time you're 13, you won't. But you can grow back you won't grow back the joint, but you'll be able to reconstruct quite a decent-looking finger. Once you get to adulthood, those growth factors, which are circulating in your bloodstream, are no longer present, and they're present because you're in the process of growing and developing, so those signals are still very active. And those signals are coded in your DNA, and there's some epigenetic trigger somewhere. So if we can locate that homeobox, if we can locate that promoter sequence, we might be able to turn it on and create tissue regeneration in adults without creating cancer. I think there's a very good chance that we'll figure that one out. Right now, when you put stem cells in, the problem is getting them to lie down flat. And it's like, have you ever tried to spackle a hole in a wall? You need one of those palette knives. If you try to just dunk the spackle on with your thumb, you can't get it smooth, and you end up with a lump. And we want nice, smooth cartilage. So the trick is getting it in there, getting it to just go to the divots in the cartilage. And I think some of what it's doing may not actually be rebuilding the cartilage. Maybe it is, but I think it may also have a very profound alteration of the environment in there by secreting factors that might be anti-inflammatory or otherwise beneficial. So I'm not quite sure what the mechanism of her success is what I'm saying. We're all assuming we're regrowing cartilage, but it may be something else.
Well, anyway, okay. Well, there's still plenty of research to be done, and I've also read that CRISPR is not nearly as precise as they thought it was in some cases. But anyway, good show, and I'll let somebody else get on here.
All right.
Well, thank you for the call.
Thanks, John. Thanks, Don. Bye.
Bye-bye.
And you're on the air with Dr. Don.
Yeah. Good evening. Well, as usual, the good doctor has said a mouthful here. I'd like to hear a little more expounding on what I heard is essentially empirical evidence of cellular memory by virtue of this DNA vulnerability expressing, in particular, as depression in an epigenetic way, if I understood it correctly. And then, just sort of as a follow-up to that, where are we in the integration of this naturopathic, allopathic paradigm with respect to having a better handle on mental illness? And the reason I asked that question was I happened to be reading today about toxoplasmosis and watching a show last night that there's some evidence that might indicate that that's a contributing factor in mental illness in a lot of homeless people. And then, in fact, as a possible positive byproduct, it's negatively indicated for multiple sclerosis. Excuse me. So I know I said a mouthful there, but
well,
again,
let's unwind it. Okay, well, I'm going to like when you have a tangle, you start with one end. So let me start with the end of what you said, because the multiple sclerosis piece and parasites, I think, is a fascinating story. And so let's start with autoimmune disease, which is what multiple sclerosis is, an attack on myelin basic protein, which is a protein found in the insulation that surrounds your nerve cells. And with, as you know, insulation makes things work better. In the case of the way the insulation on nerves is, it allows for a much more rapid transmission of information along the nerve, speeding it up more than tenfold. So people with multiple sclerosis, their nerves are still connected, but the information, the signal is flowing too slowly to do any good. So they develop paralysis and all sorts of manifestations. The presence of a parasite in the body changes the immune system in a fundamental way. It leads to the increase of something called T suppressor cells, and it redirects the immune system against the parasite and away from self. So these this has been demonstrated quite well in gut disease like Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis, that if you give people a parasite, you can induce a remission in their autoimmune disease. And, oh, by the way, it seems to also induce remissions in people who happen to have arthritis and Crohn's disease, and so they're getting the treatment for Crohn's disease. That's anecdotal. I don't know of any studies that have looked at parasites and psoriasis, but there may indeed be some. There are also studies that show that certain bacteria seem to be triggers of flare-ups. So rheumatoid arthritis, for example, and Proteus mirabilis, if you have, if you get an infection with this bacteria in your gut, you're likely to have a rheumatoid arthritis flare. And we think that's because the resemblance between the bacteria and the target of the antibody, or in the case of rheumatoid arthritis, the T cells, is a close match, and so it's a mistaken identity. So it's possible that we're getting this with the toxoplasmosis and the multiple sclerosis, a benefit because we're down-regulating the immune system. Now, toxoplasmosis and mental illness is completely plausible. And there is research going back, I think, easily 15 years, because I've been telling this story for 15 years because I think it's so fascinating. You know the crazy cat ladies, right?
Right.
It's a cultural stereotype, but it's a thing. And there are people who live in a very messy, untidy environment with, you know, 15 to 30 cats, and their neighbors are all complaining, and they're a little bit eccentric, and you walk into their house and you're like, oh, the smell, right? But they can't smell it because toxoplasmosis turns off your ability to smell cat urine and a number of other things as well. And this is completely part of the life cycle of the toxoplasmosis parasite, is because it has to go through a mouse and be eaten by a cat. And then its spores go to the cat's bloodstream, get peed out, or pooped out. Sorry, it is the gut. Misspoke. So the parasite goes through the cat's gut and get pooped out, and that's why pregnant women shouldn't change cat litter boxes, because they will get toxoplasmosis and it causes birth defects.
Wow.
So when the mouse gets toxoplasmosis, the toxoplasmosis goes to the mouse's brain, and the mice begin to behave very oddly. They do not smell cat urine, because there's a characteristic behavior that you see in mice when they smell cat urine. And when a cat is actually presented to them, they go about their business. They don't run. They
right.
stop being afraid of cats. So we know that it gets into humans. We know that it has, because it's been found in the brains of the crazy cat ladies. It's a real thing. They're all positive for it. So why wouldn't it be something that could be associated with homelessness and aberrant behavior? We know it is. So I completely buy into that. Now, you're going to have to unwind the thread back from there, because I know you had several
okay.
several others.
Well, so I guess where I'm really going with this is with the idea that maybe what's really happening here is that the brain is just sort of the raw computer chip of the human computer, and the gut is really where all of the programming and control language is taking place. Because if glutamine is feeding cancer and we're seeing these epigenetic changes that are not necessarily hereditary, then I don't understand how else they could be affecting the expression or manifestation of genes, if except for maybe, I don't know, toxic waste or nuclear fallout or something, it's got to be coming from the gut, doesn't it?
Yeah, and I want to point out that you can, you know, there was a book a long time ago called The Selfish Gene, and the idea was that really we are just the DNA's way of getting itself reproduced. It's really the DNA is in the driver's seat. And it's all in how you frame it. So I'm going to reframe us to this concept of coevolution. So you start out with bacteria, and bacteria have had a long time to get very, very sophisticated. Their generation time is somewhere between 20 minutes and 2 hours. So they can evolve very quickly. It's a highly competitive environment for resources. So they've had to get very smart and very tricky in order to survive. And many compounds produced by bacteria or fungi, another great producer of interesting stuff, are also going to have an effect on our bodies, because ultimately we all started from the same primordial ooze, and the materials that the bacteria and the plants use for one purpose, we use for another. So there's this huge symphony of signaling that's occurred between every discrete species that has ever existed on the planet. And we're just now beginning to reframe to think of this as a co-evolution, the whole microbiome thing. So we evolved with these bacteria, which evolved to be optimized to live in their environment, which happens to be on the inside of me. I'm a sophisticated donut, and they live in the center of my donut.
Yeah, we're optimized for them.
well, and vice versa. We actually can only survive with these bacteria. If you sterilize the human gut, the person will die of vitamin deficiency. There are a number of nutrients that we don't make. So like termites, we need those bacteria to help us both digest and process our foods such that we can be alive. That's why when babies are born, we give them a vitamin K injection, because they'll bleed otherwise, and hemorrhage. And we give them vitamin K because they don't have any bacteria in their gut yet. And they're very vulnerable. Wow. So it's a symphony, a very complex one. And we grew together and always have been. So it makes sense that the bacteria would want to optimize their environment. So they've evolved ways of speaking to the brain to change our eating behavior. When a person stops eating sugar, they go through a massive die-off of sugar-loving bacteria in their gut, and they start fantasizing about donuts. They'll have visions. I mean, I have patients I've held their hands as they went through this. They're not just craving, they're seeing. They're seeing the donut the way I used to see my bed when I was on 36 hours on my shift as an intern, and I'd start having fantasies about pillows. Honest to God, I did.
I guess to kind of wrap this up then, is all of that epigenetic? Is all of this just genetic information responding to what is being thrown at it?
I think that there's no single thing that is it here, but epigenetics turns out to be a critical signaling and modification lever. It's one of the major places that the environment has leverage on the genome. And so that's how I think about it. The way that the environment speaks to the body is through epigenetic modification of the DNA, and turning on and off what the DNA does is how the environment changes us.
Wow, fascinating. Thank you so much. I'll let it go.
All right, thanks for your call. Appreciate hearing from you.
That was a fun geek out.
Yeah. We're on the air.
Hi, yes, I'm fascinated by the show, as always, with Dr. Don. However, if you haven't touched base with this before, I would like to switch to policy. And what do you think of SB 562?
SB 562. Can you tell me if that's...
That's the California... Medicare for All.
Medicare for All. Okay, I thought it might be, but I didn't know the... All right, so first of all, let's talk about Medicare and what's good and bad about it. Do we need to have a single healthcare plan for everybody? You bet we do. Okay, policy-wise, that's where we should be going, in my opinion. I want to insist that all elected officials use the system that we create. And that is important because we have got all of Europe to look at and see what went wrong with implementation of various forms of national health. And we have a wonderful learning laboratory if we walk around there. Now, admittedly, you know, these are ends of one. These are all different, and they are different cultures and la, la, la. But let's take England, okay? So England's hit very hard during the Blitz. They have private health care before World War II. Afterwards, they have national health. I mean, the country's basically bombed to shreds, at least the capital cities. They've got to do something to pull people together. They create a national health system, among other things. And it goes really well for a while until in the 80s you get Margaret Thatcher and you get Reaganomics and you get the trickle-down theory. And what happens is they stop fixing the roofs in the hospitals and it really does start to trickle down. And that's the problem you have to do difficult things like raise taxes and spend money to keep your healthcare infrastructure strong. And England had a hard time doing that because no one wanted to raise taxes, and you'd get the conservatives in and they would cut taxes, and then there wasn't any revenue to do more than pay for the minimal social services or major social services, depending upon your point of view, that they had. But there certainly wasn't enough to build or fix hospitals. And so they ended up having serious deterioration of their healthcare infrastructure. And I would argue that we are currently looking at an infrastructure crisis in this country on our roads, in our bridges, that is due to exactly the same problem. It's difficult for people who have to stand for election to raise taxes. And there's always someone who would rather promise not to raise taxes and kick the problem of infrastructure down the road. So the way that you fix that in healthcare is that Pat Ryan is going to have to go to the same emergency room that I am.
Yeah.
And if you have skin in the game, you have a really different attitude about the healthcare system. So I believe that currently why we're in such a fix is because all federal employees and anyone who's in elected office, and for that matter, if you work for the University of California or any government agency in California, you're in a bubble. You're in a healthcare paradise that is nothing like what the rest of us are dealing with. You have low copays. You do not have a $6,000 deductible, or if you're lucky enough to be able to afford insurance in the first place, and you don't get the runaround because you've got the proverbial 10-ton gorilla purchasing your health care, and they'll just take that contract and shop it out to somebody else if they don't get a good plan for their people. Now, we need that kind of attitude about all the people, and I think the only way to ensure it is what I've just said. With respect to the specifics of this bill, I think it's a good bill. I don't see a lot of problems with it. I think we would, if it passed in the form that's being discussed, we would end up with an influx of people moving to California with lots of diseases, and so we will have to think about that one because we will become a it's not that hard to move to California, and goodness knows if the healthcare is that much better, and people need healthcare and can't get it. Well, what do you expect? What do you expect is going to happen?
Well, they have to afford a house first.
No, they don't.
Oh, they don't?
They have to establish, I think all they have to do is establish residency.
Well, no, what I mean is to get a house here is another big problem.
Well, you can get a trailer hookup when you move your mobile home.
There you go.
Those will run, if you own the mobile home, you know, plus the cost of moving, those will run you $200 a month. It's doable.
Yeah, all you got to do is find a place to put it.
Well, I propose that if this passes, there will be a boom in mobile home commute parks.
I bet there will be.
I'm sorry, caller. I'm taking this probably away from the direction you wanted. Any follow-up questions?
No. I was interested in basically your overall take on it. I believe that it's a serious gamble for the state,
yes,
but probably one worth taking just because of the incredibly high costs of medical care for virtually everyone, old and young alike, seniors included.
Yeah.
So
it'll kick up our taxes. Let's just agree that we will pay more taxes, and in return for which people will have justice.
Indeed.
I'm okay with that. All right.
Hey, thanks for your call. We appreciate it. Hi, you're on the air with Dr. Don.
Hi there. First of all, I love the selfish gene reference that you made earlier.
Oh, thank you.
And then second, I want to know if you could explain the difference between high-dose antioxidant supplements versus foods that create antioxidants.
Or contain them more accurately.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I am in favor of food. I'm a strong supporter of food, and I think that the form of antioxidants that's present in food and the ratios that are present in food are probably important. And while I do use supplements in a targeted fashion, as I alluded to with respect to cancer management, I think the best place to get your antioxidants is in food, because I am certain that there are thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of compounds we have yet to identify which are beneficial and that probably work synergistically with the antioxidants that we have identified. And so I would like people to get all of those things in their diet, because I think that's where we derive the most benefit. But when you're treating let's say you want to treat inflammation because you've got inflammation, I'd so much rather use high-dose curcumin than non-steroidal anti-inflammatories, which are going to mess with the gut and cause problems down the line. So there's the idea of good nutrition with all of these antioxidants embedded in the food. What happens with many of them is that they're free radical scavengers. So from a biochemical standpoint, what antioxidants do is they're like a wet sponge in a blacksmith shop. The spark comes out. That spark is an oxygen molecule called a free radical. It can interact with anything, and it's going to mess up DNA if it hits some DNA. And so you want to catch that like a spark in a blacksmith shop on a wet floor or against a sponge, and you don't want it hitting straw, where it's going to flare up and cause potentially a cancer. So this oxidative stress, it messes with everything. It messes with our cell walls. It's not just the DNA. It oxidizes, forms peroxide in our cell walls. It makes them less flexible, which interferes with brain function. So there's a lot of reasons that we want plenty of free radicals around. At the same time, the oxidative stressors that we get when we exercise are actually potentially beneficial because they stimulate our DNA to do good things, including making our own internal antioxidants. So I do worry that someone who's taking very, very high doses of antioxidant supplements might actually be messing with their own physiology a little bit. Now, there's not solid data on that. It's more of a theoretical concern. But given that we have this tendency to just double down and get too extreme on stuff, I want to say until we've actually validated that as the best way to go, maybe we should just hold back a little and be very targeted when we use high doses of things. And I try to be very targeted. And when you've got cancer, all bets are off. I'm giving you a ton of green tea, and I'm giving you a ton of curcumin and resveratrol and quercetin, because I want to mess with the DNA. I do want to mess with the DNA. And, you know, if you get a cancer 50 years from now because I messed with your DNA at 20, yeah, good. That I'll take that.
Great. So continuing on the idea of taking very high doses, I've also heard of vitamin D's capability of preventing cancer.
Yes.
I'm not really sure about this, because I haven't necessarily looked at all the studies, and I'm sure there's a heavy industry influence in selling vitamin D supplements. So what's your take on that?
Well, first of all, there's great evidence on autoimmune disease and cancer, and it's, I'd say, fairly disinterested evidence. A lot of it's epidemiological, but there is also in vitro, you know, looking at vitamin D levels in cancer cells, looking at the behavior and change of cancer of cells in humans. Most, you know, I'm thinking of Dean Ornish's work on prostate cancer, which is one of my favorite things because he actually tracks people and you watch the prostate cancer's epigenetics essentially shift such that the cells become less aggressive and you can see them becoming less aggressive with diet, among other things, high-dose vitamin D. So I think the data is pretty solid. The question is in the dosing. Now, vitamin D in particular is a hormone, and hormones have a really interesting property, which is if you give a whole lot of a hormone, you tend to turn off the receptors for the hormone, which replicates the same situation as if you didn't have enough hormone to hit the receptors. Well, now the receptors have effectively gone deaf. Think about insulin resistance. I mean, that's an example we all understand, I think, that people eat too much sugar, their body puts out too much insulin, fast forward 35 years, and now they don't hear their own insulin, and they've got type 2 diabetes. Well, if we gave people, say, 50,000 units of vitamin D daily, we'd probably turn off or turn down their vitamin D receptors. We might even end up causing osteopenia or osteomalacia, because the vitamin D wouldn't be able to work because the receptors would have gone deaf from these high doses. So we have to be careful with something that has a hormone-like effect, that in other words has a designated receptor that it fits into, and that's not the majority of things that we call antioxidants.
Okay, so to sum it up, your advice for someone who lives in Santa Cruz, who let's say doesn't get much sun during the winter, should they strictly rely on the sun during the summer to build up their vitamin D levels for the winter, or should they supplement?
They should supplement. And what I would recommend is keep your vitamin D levels in the 40 to 60 range if you're a healthy young person. And if you have autoimmune disease or any kind of inflammatory disease, like let's say arthritis, it's fine to kick it up to the 60 to 80 range. And so get blood levels annually. If you're supplementing, I find that if I have people take 5,000 units a day, and let's say they start out at 20, and I check them 3 months later, they're in the 30s, and I check them 3 years later, they're in the 60s. So it takes a very, very long time to get that vitamin D level up at 5,000 a day, but your body can make about 10,000 from sun in a day. So that is my threshold dose. I don't want to throw anything more at the body than what the body would naturally produce on its own under ideal circumstances. And so,
right. So
that's my, don't take more than 10,000. It's fine to take that. If you're taking more than 5,000, do check a level, you know, after 3 months at that. And then if it's gone way up fast, that means you're absorbing, you're an unusually fast absorber, and you probably need to drop the dose.
Great. Cool.
All right. Hey, thanks for your call. We appreciate it. Bye-bye. And I'm going to get in a question here before the next caller does.
Sure.
I have a friend who has just discovered she has stage 3 breast cancer. And I'm trying to understand what that means in the scope of 1, 2, 4, and I guess there's no 5. There's just four stages.
Right, there's just 4 stages.
So what is 2 and what is 4?
Okay, well, staging is based on a number of factors. It's based on the size of the tumor, and it's based on whether it looks like that tumor may have left the immediate neighborhood. Has Elvis left the building, in other words? And if he has left the building, exactly where in the building did he get? So, for example, with stage 2 cancer, you could have a small cancer, less than 2 centimeters, and, stage 1, let's start with stage 1. Stage 1 is a small tumor that hasn't spread. Stage 2 is a it means that it's invasive. So it's got some cancer somewhere, in the lymph nodes. So you've gotten out of the building, and now you're in the lymph nodes, and you have a tumor of some size. It can also mean that you've got a big tumor and your lymph nodes are clean. So it's the staging's kind of confusing. It gets more confusing when you get to when you move to stage three. Surprise, surprise. So stage three, the tumor is always bigger than 2 centimeters, and that's kind of a threshold. And it also means that it's in some lymph nodes. So if you've got it in a lot of lymph nodes, then they may even bump you up. So if you've got like 9 lymph nodes positive, you would be a stage 3, even if it's smaller than 2 centimeters, because if it's in 9 lymph nodes, it's aggressive. And so we're trying to track how aggressive is this. And these are all based on, you know, trying to say, okay, what chemotherapy and combination of radiation, chemotherapy, and surgery is most likely to do the job of getting rid of the cancer with the minimum devastation, because all of our cancer therapies are slash and burn therapies. And so we don't want to do stuff that's unnecessary. You could argue, for example, that removing both breasts because you have a gene that predisposes you to breast cancer is overkill. And, you know, I don't fault any woman who does that, but I think at our current state of knowledge, that's probably, you know, definitely on the extreme end of what might be the right behavior. My advice to someone who has that is read up about other factors that influence cancer. Don't drink alcohol. Control your hormones. Control your stress. Get rid of any toxic people in your life. And exercise.
Always exercise.
Yes.
Is stage 3... That they determine how to treat it? Is that what you're saying? If it's in stage 3, they haven't really started treating this person yet.
Well, stage 3, you walk through the door and you get staged.
Yeah.
So if you've got a cancer, the first thing they do is CT scan and lymph node biopsy.
Yeah, they've done that.
You know, and does she have positive lymph nodes?
That have cancer in them? Is that what you mean by positive?
Uh-huh.
As far as I know, yes.
Okay. So in that case, that is going to mean chemotherapy.
Mm-hmm.
Not just local surgery and radiation, but now you're going to need to do chemotherapy. And so what those cancer cells have in the way of receptors on them, do they have estrogen receptors? That's good, because you can mess with those receptors. Are they triple negative? They got no estrogen receptors. There's something else called HER2-NU, which is another receptor on the surface of the cancer cells. If you've got that, there's some drugs that work really well for that. And so you can have a longer survival, although in the long run, the cancer tends to come back when you've got that one. So your best bet is be estrogen and progesterone receptor positive. Those are the easiest ones to treat and have the highest cure rate.
All right. Hi, you're on the air with Dr. Don.
I have a kind of specific question. It brings together two things you actually were talking about. The first of which, you mentioned different bacteria in the stomach changing behavior / giving depression. But really, that was just something you mentioned that kind of inspired me. But the real question I have is my girlfriend has a long-term issue with heartburn. Mm-hmm. She got it specifically from what we believe was just exposure to contaminated water.
Mm-hmm.
She just one day had a just terrible, terrible, all the symptoms you would imagine, and she has never shook it. And it's been pushing a year and a half now.
Mm-hmm.
So... And I've done everything I can. We've gone through the rigor mole, and she's gone through every major prescribed treatment. And either she doesn't like the effects on her stomach that they have, or she just the symptoms proceed, even though.
Go ahead. Sorry.
Go right ahead. Sorry, I'm just ranting.
I wanted to ask if she had been tested for H. pylori, because that is found in contaminated water.
This is an interesting question. I had heard about that, I think, from you or from somewhere else, and from one of the nurses one of the times we actually went to the local hospital.
Mm-hmm.
But when we actually went and asked them, well, how do we go and test for this, we got a bunch of runaround.
Really?
That's one of the things. My father's research did, they came up with the answer having two different antibiotics and it being really common and hard to treat, but again, resources, et cetera.
All right, so let me just talk a little bit about when you say, okay, I drank water from a stream and I've never been the same since. There's two bugs that come to mind, and one of them is H. pylori. The other's Giardia, which tends to cause more gas and bloating and more lower GI symptoms, not so much heartburn. Both of these can be tested for with stool testing. And so that might be worth looking into. There is a stool antigen for H. pylori. There's also a breath test where you drink a liquid, and H. pylori breaks up nitrogen, actually. It breaks off a nitrogen, and so when you exhale, the nitrogen pops up. And I'm sorry, I don't remember, I'm blanking on what exactly they test for, but it's basically a physiologic test. So the H. pylori changes a compound that you drink, and then they can pick it out of your exhaled air. And that allows us to identify the presence of living bacteria. The stool antigen test can be a false negative. It can miss the disease. The gastroenterologists love to do an upper endoscopy and clip out a little piece of skin from the lining of the stomach, because the H. pylori lives inside the cell. And it's, oddly enough, it's related to syphilis in terms of the type of bacterium it is. But anyway, it causes an increase in stomach acid, and it's an irritant, but it likes an acidic environment, so it raises stomach acid, and it can lead to a lot of heartburn as a result of that. So, you know, the symptoms are certainly suggestive of that problem. What I would suggest you do is to ask for one of these tests. Now, my producer, full credit to my producer, just came in and handed me a paper saying, no, it's urea, not nitrogen. I was close, but no cigar, Don. There is nitrogen in urea. So if urea comes out when she breathes, then that means that she has it. And that's a relatively cheap test. That's like a $20, $30 test. She should be able to find that. Calling around, I would call various doctor's office and say, do you do a urea breath test for H. pylori? And if so, what would you charge me to come in and do it? See if you can start with private offices. Don't go to the big outfits that have initials. Basically, any doctor's office that's got six offices and is known by its initials is not going to accommodate the public. They're going to expect the public to accommodate to it.
We found that out to be the case.
And all right, Don, thank you so much. It's always a pleasure to have you here. And he's gone.
Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDon.com for news about our future plans, or follow my tweets at AskDrDon. For now, this is Dr. Don saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Don is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.